This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, your host, hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices episode 97 was pre-recorded back in late November 2017 to air on December 28th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Happy holidays. This special edition of Macro Voices will not include a market wrap or postgame segment. Instead, the entire episode is dedicated to part three of our 2017 year-end special, Anatomy of the U.S. Dollar Endgame, featuring Alhambra Investment CIO Jeffrey Snyder, Morgan Creek founder Mark Yusko, and Forest for the Trees founder Luke Groman. You definitely want to listen to parts one and two of this series first, so if you missed them, please go to macrovoices.com and start with episode 95, which aired back on December 24th. You'll also want to be sure to download both Mark Yusko and Luke Groman's slide decks, as they provide the outline and reference material for this entire episode. Macro Voices registered users will find the download links in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to macrovoices.com and look for registration and download instructions on our homepage. Now let's get back to the conversation with our guests. We finished the discussion over Jeff Snyder's slide deck at the end of the last episode, but only after using up all of our planned two-hour time budget for this project. So I'd like to take a moment to publicly thank our guests, who very graciously agreed to put in a huge amount of extra time and energy beyond what they had initially committed to in order to make sure that we did justice to this subject matter. This is an undertaking that would wind up taking several more hours. In the interest of time, Mark Yusko volunteered off the air to just present his slide deck with minimal group interaction. Now, Mark told us that there was plenty that he wanted to discuss with the group, but he'd already reviewed Luke Groman's slide deck, and he knew that every single one of his hot topics was already going to come up again in Luke's deck. So the first 20 minutes of today's episode will be Mark presenting his slide deck. The next 20 minutes will be a group discussion with reactions to Mark's deck. Finally, we'll jump into the beginning of Luke Groman's slide deck, which we'll finish in the next episode, airing on December 30th. Let's start with Mark Yusko. Gentlemen, I'm going to suggest that we shift gears here. We've had Jeff Snyder in the hot seat for quite a while now, a little bit longer than we'd originally planned. And I think that we should probably move on to Mark Yusko's slide deck next. Just to summarize, it's very interesting to me. I think we really are all in agreement that what's going on here is we're seeing the U.S. dollar endgame beginning to play out. And the only place we disagree is how the details of that are going to work out and whether that might create this short squeeze effect, which Jeff and I think could be dollar bullish in the short term. But I think we all see it as part of a process, which is the U.S. dollar's hegemony over the financial system is ending. So on that note, let's go ahead and move into Mark Yusko's slide. Mark, take it away.
Thanks, Eric. Start off with some fun cartoons on the cover here, the not-so-almighty dollar. And I think it's amazing, the curse of the Economist cover, you know, literally the peak in the dollar at 103 last December, DXY, the week of the Economist cover, showing the buff George Washington there. I like the guy on the right with the renminbi knocking out the dollar. So we'll talk about a bunch of different things. I like these words of wisdom on the second page here in the Morgan Creek deck. The almighty dollar is true divinity and its worship is universal. Pretty amazing from the first woman inducted into National Geographic Society. In a word, the almighty dollar is a great object of universal devotion throughout our land, seems to have no genuine devotees in these peculiar villages. So Washington Irving noticed that in certain villages that he visited, they didn't care about the dollar. They didn't care about that means of wealth transfer. So it is worshipped universally around the world, but not necessarily in all places. I wrote about Yogi Berra recently, nickel ain't worth a dime anymore. That's the devaluation of the currency over time. And who would have thunk I would have paid $8.50 for a cup of coffee in Switzerland a couple months ago? Crazy. But I'd soon leave my son a curse as the almighty dollar from Andrew Carnegie. I love that one. So look, back in January of 16, we actually made the case the first time, used this term that King Dollar would get dethroned. We really thought that the Chinese currency was beginning its ascension into a world reserve currency. Ultimately, we think long-term, the world reserve currency. And one thing that I think people forget is that the dollar peaks when the Fed actually raises rates. Historically, it's around that second hike when the dollar tends to head down. The dollar anticipates the Fed, in other words. So it actually is contrary to what most people think, that the Fed raising rates here again in a couple weeks is going to be good for the dollar. We actually think it's negative. And you can kind of see it in the slide on the left here on page 5. That bottom line is the dollar, we think, really did peak back in 2016. You had the little Trump bump, which was just the lunacy around all of his promises about the trifecta. And on the right-hand side, the trade-weighted dollar clearly has been in a downtrend, we think, and made a nice double top. So if you think about just the dollar in a secular sense, the left-hand side of page 6, we think it's been in secular decline really since the 80s. And this is just the race to the bottom in the developed world, as all of us, 10,000 people every day in the United States and Europe turn 65. That's 10,000 each. That's 20,000 people every single day turn 65 for the next 17 years. And stability is really the watchword with the renminbi. And I love this box in green on page 7, which basically there's a lot of stuff up there from Larry at TIS Group. But I think what people miss is that the Chinese play a long-term game. And here's the word we've been talking about over the last few hours is hegemony. It is China's objective is not to follow the devaluation route of other countries for the renminbi or the yuan to be seen as a stable unit of appreciation that central banks and financial institutions feel comfortable holding in their portfolios. That is a profound statement, that they actually think that central banks and financial institutions will hold renminbi as a stable unit of appreciation. That is a huge shift from a decade ago or two decades ago. So in January this year, we said the King Dollar was making its last stand and that DXY would weaken. I got absolutely ridiculed for this. And as I've said many times, the height of a good investment idea is when you're being ridiculed soundly. So the ridicule to goodness factor is a pretty good indicator to watch. What was interesting is you had a DeMarc 9 count the same week as the Economist cover. That's on page 9. But we felt that the dollar was in this cyclical pattern within a secular downtrend, so that it made its cyclical peak intra-period, and now it was going to head back down on its secular path on page 10. The dollar bulls, though, and there were many, thought that, you know, Trump was like Reagan, and the white line in this chart was the dollar was going to go much, much higher. And at least some were more, well, maybe not Reagan, he's probably more like Bush. And so we just kind of meander and maybe go up a little bit. We think he's neither. We think he's more like Herbert Hoover. You know, he's only the third president elected with no experience. He came in making huge promises, like in the upper right hand of page 12. And we think that stock market, the ride was going to be this bubble top because of all the things that people believed that Trump would deliver. And what's really kind of frightening about that is on page 13, we know exactly what happened when Hoover was elected. You had this spike in the markets. Everybody was bulled up. Currency was strengthening. And then things started to happen. We had a little recession and then a bunch of really bad decisions, like the Mexican Repatriation Act, where we tried to kick out Mexicans back to Mexico, even though some were U.S. citizens, to try to save American jobs. That was a bad plan. Just like it's a bad plan now. And then Smoot-Hawley, which was the killer. And so what we saw was this trade war. They call it a war for a reason. There are no winners in a trade war. And so what you see on the left-hand side of page 14 is the CPI just absolutely collapsed along with the markets. And it was an ugly period. And we kind of meandered along. We had a little dead cat bounce. And then we came up to 37. And in 37, that's when the really bad stuff started. That's the Fed tried to raise interest rates, tried to get us out of zero interest rates and QE. By the way, QE is not new. We did it all throughout the 30s. And what people forget is in a trade war, everybody lost, but the U.S. lost the most. Our exports went down the most. Why? Because everybody else fought back. they're not going to lay down and take it. And gold, which was equivalent to the dollar, because the dollar was good as gold and backed by gold, collapsed. And so we had a massive devaluation in our currency. So coming into this year, 85% on page 17, 85% believed that the dollar would be strong this year. Pretty much if 85% of people believe something, you should do the opposite. Pretty simple. Dollar went into free fall starting in December. And we said in September, we do these monthly around the world calls. We said in September that it was looking really oversold. And people had flip-flopped and people had gotten a little bullish. We thought there could be a cyclical little mini rally. So there was one more rally that was likely to happen. DeMarc signaled that as well. And it actually bottomed on the day that Trump cut the deal with the Democrats. Now, there was no actual deal, but he said he cut a deal because he always cuts a deal because he's, you know, the art of the deal guy. The dollar made a bunch of divergences that signaled that there could be and likely would be a short-term rally from 92 up to as high as 95. The dollar was getting thrashed here on page 21. And what's really interesting about that is turned on a dime on that September 8th day. And I think that was a problem. So traders reversed. Page 22 shows that traders really did go from being super bulled up to actually pretty bearish. And now we're back to neutral today.
If I could just interrupt for a second, Mark, you talked about the dollar reversing in early September. That's the exact same time that we saw the repo market fail spike.
That is very interesting.
Just something to keep in mind.
Yeah.
The week of September 7th.
Luke, you have any thoughts on that either?
No. Go ahead. Keep going.
I think, Jeff, you bring up a really important point that these things are all interconnected. You know, all these markets and all of these activities. And I think what happens is somebody makes a statement or somebody makes a policy move, and then it gets picked up and it gets exaggerated in the media. And then suddenly people actually start acting and people have trades that go against them and things actually happen in the real world and trades start to fail, which is your point. What I think is really, I won't say disconcerting because I'm not so worried. You know, the UK is still a pretty cool place, even though they haven't been the world reserve currency since 1944. And so it's not like they go away if you lose world reserve currency status. And Portugal is still a great place, even though they were the world reserve currency for most of the 1600s, because they're the most powerful navy, because they had the tallest masts, because they owned the tallest forests until the UK took them over, or Spain actually first and then the UK. But what I think is interesting is this chart on page 23 that shows that, you know, 50% of the world's population live in this pivot area, the cradle of civilization. And it's really interesting when you think about that's where they put all the oil. And it's really been kind of a cruel joke, if we think about it, that this thing that we all fight over and people have died over all sits under this sand in the middle of the desert, and a certain small number of people are in charge of it, and yet we all make it our whole purpose of our life to get close to it. And I think there's an interesting dynamic going on here in that, you know, China is now the biggest importer of Saudi oil, not the United States. So there's going to be a lot of deals that I think happen around this pivot area and this natural seat of power. And what I think that does, and at least for me, is on page 24, you saw this collapse in emerging market currencies. And again, that appeared as dollar strength, but I'm going to argue that what it was we're all in a big race to the bottom. And the dollar was just the least dirty shirt. I hate that term, but we'll use it. And that the EM currencies were just collapsing more. And so they collapsed all the way from 11 to 16. But starting in 16, they got cheap enough to change. And so where I think we are is very much like we were in 2000. And a whole series of slides that I borrowed from Ralph Paul, who I think has been on this show a couple times, on page 25 at GMI, is that if you look at global trade and what happened in kind of 94 to 2002, and really in that 2000, 2001, 2002 period, you had this little mini spike around the last part of the bubble in 99, and then you had just a collapse. And sure enough, we're collapsing just as we would be in 2000, 2001, 2002. U.S. leading economic indicators did the same thing. U.S. consumer confidence, it always peaks at the top. That's the way it works. It's actually really bad at the bottom, and it peaks at the top. You've seen that was page 26. On page 27, something that makes me very nervous is people are dipping into their savings to finance a lifestyle that they probably shouldn't be trying to finance. And what we know is that future GDP growth is inextricably linked to decreases in savings. So decreases in savings cut about 2/3 of a point of GDP for every 1 point decrease in savings. So we know that there's going to be lower GDP growth in the future because people have been trimming the savings rate from 8% right after the financial crisis, coming up on 3% now. So on page 28, rates might not rise as much as people think. There was this little blip up in 2000, and then we had to cut rates in 2001 when the recession hit. And I think we could see a repeat of that sometime next year in 18, or maybe it's the first quarter of 19. Page 29, bad demographics, they lead to deflation and lower interest rates. And I think the lows in the 10-year interest rate are far ahead of us, not behind us. And the great bond bear market is not over. 2000 to 2002, the dollar was very strong. So here's where I get cognitive dissonance, is there was on the right-hand side of page 30, this very nice inverse head and shoulders and a break up in the dollar. And here's where, on top of Jeff's views, I have to say, boy, it's definitely possible that the short run, like the next year, we could see a very strong dollar. And then you get the big crack at the end of next year into 2019. And that would correspond, interestingly, with W.D. Gann in 1909, based on his reading of this book by Samuel Benner that he put together in 1902. So think about this. These two charts were put together over 100 years ago, and they mapped out what would happen every year in the future for the next 100 and plus years. And actually, Gann's chart ended in 2008. He predicted the 2008 turn down. Benner's went all the way out to 2021. And it basically says that we're going to have the next crisis, red box and red circle, in 2019. And that actually lines up well with Jeremy Grantham coming out and saying the bubble's going to run for another 15, 16 months. And so that would put us right in that first quarter of March timeframe of 2019. So pretty amazing to think that this guy could write a book in 1902 and it could be accurate out for over 100 years. So if history rhymes, that inverse head and shoulders pattern that we saw in 2000 did actually repeat here. And so we should have this move up. Instead, it moved back down to 93.67. Now it's back to 94. So maybe we are going to have that move back up. DXY is hanging by a thread on that 200-day. If it bounces off and it is upwardly sloping, it is possible that Jeff's situation could play out here. Now, counter to that, a guy I respect a lot, Larry Jedilo at TIS Group, follows this thing called the Coppock Curve, and he's saying that DXY is actually targeting much lower lows at 75 to 85. And then again, something I like is if you look at inflation in the G7, it's been accelerating modestly, which would tell us that the DXY target would be somewhere between 80 and 85. So to summarize, the dollar just doesn't fare very well if you think about, you know, the fundamental and monetary factor, or what are the fundamental factors that drive, here on page 36, whether a currency should be strong. So countries with strong growth have strong currencies. We do not have strong growth. Contrary to popular belief, sub 2% is not strong. Stability of a currency.
It's not growth either.
It's really not growth. Exactly. Thank you, Jeff. It's really not. It's stall speed at best. And, you know, stability of the currency and having a current account surplus. We have a current account deficit in the U.S., not a surplus. Countries that have higher interest rates are attractive. I think we're going to end up with lower interest rates, not higher interest rates. So all three big X's. Now, from a monetary policy perspective, yeah, okay, fine. I call that neutral. And capital flows and risk aversion, we are still viewed as a safe haven, although I don't really understand why, but we still are. So hashtag King Dollar dethroned. Welcome to the multipolar world. And again, Larry sums up for us, what does it mean to have this monetary reset? We had the new SDR basket. We had all these countries playing around with negative yields. We are moving to this cashless society, demonetization. We've got the fintech. We can spend a whole nother 2 hours or 4 hours probably talking about Bitcoin. We won't do that today. But I think there are real implications for where we're headed, and the time is now to get ready.
Reactions from Jeff and Luke to Mark's deck.
You know, Mark, it's interesting. You highlighted that 2000 to 2002 time frame, and you know, there's something I'll touch on, but I talked about, you know, it's all fun and games until U.S. tax receipts fall. When you look at that dollar strength from 2000 to 2002 as sort of the analog, U.S. tax receipts were on a trailing 12-month basis were still running up over 15% in early 01. They were still up 10% as late as mid 01. They didn't fall until very late 01. And by the time they were down year over year, about 3%, it looks to be about December 01 or January of 02, after which point, to my point, the dollar got hit very quickly. And I don't remember if that was, you know, Fed cuts or if that was, I think the Treasury Secretary was Snow at that point, if he started talking about weaker dollar. But the point is that it was interesting to see that chart and that analog of 2000 to 2002, because at least when I look through that lens of they'll let the dollar strengthen until they start choking out the U.S. government, that didn't dissuade me from that. So I thought that was interesting.
Well, no, I think you're dead right on, Luke. It's really interesting. If you go back, everybody wants to compare Trump to all these other people. You know, they want to, you know, compare him to Reagan. It's just no comparison. Demographically, there's no comparison. Culturally, there's no comparison. Personality-wise, there's no comparison. Just no comparison. Then they want to say, well, it's like Bush. Well, that actually works in the sense that, you know, 2000 to 2002, we had the same kind of challenges. The difference is, and it's a massive difference, is economic growth was running 4 or 5% back in 2000.
And the U.S. had a surplus, you know, when he took office.
We had a surplus. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't running it at 2% with a massive deficit. And so your point on tax receipts is tax receipts were going great up until the shallow recession. You know, the funny thing about the 01 recession is first quarter was negative, second quarter was positive, third quarter was negative. So we didn't even have two consecutive quarters. We had a very mild recession. And tax receipts were starting to roll down a little bit. But then what happened was 9/11. And then you had the big collapse in the economic growth. And that's when I think, to your point, I think Snow and everybody else had to start talking down the dollar because tax receipts were collapsing. Budget deficit was squarely in sight. You know, that's what the government does. Now, that's why I just don't get how they can backtrack from what they started saying, you know, both Mnuchin and Cohen. About 3-4 months ago over the summer, we're starting to jawbone down the dollar because they knew the tax receipts were already falling even before they talked about this lunacy of cutting taxes on the rich. It just makes my skin crawl.
I'd like to introduce a thought of my own to all of this and get everyone's reactions, which is I don't have Jeff's depth of understanding of the Eurodollar system. So my dollar bullish argument is a little bit different than Jeff's. And it's simply that I don't think the world is ready to let go yet of the U.S. dollar and U.S. treasuries being the safety trade. And I don't think that it's because everybody's in love with U.S. treasuries and the U.S. dollar, but simply because there's really no viable alternative. And I think there's a lot of things wrong in the world, particularly in Europe and in Japan. And as things go bump in the night, I think there will be eventually a recession or another financial crisis that will result in, I don't think the safety trade is going to be into European sovereigns, even at the expense of currency risk. I think that European institutions, wherever their mandates allow them to, if a crisis starts, their safety trade is going to be into U.S. treasuries. And I think that's the reason that I see the dollar benefiting from the next thing that goes wrong in the world, not because of any fundamental strength in the currency, but because we don't have an alternative as the safety trade. I think you alluded to that a little bit, Mark, where you said you don't think it's really going to be the safety trade anymore. I think that was one of your last points. I guess my question is, what would it be instead then?
Yeah, look, that is one thing, Eric, where I am compelled by your logic, which is I don't think we're ready to call China the safe haven. I don't think we're ready for it to be the world reserve currency. Bitcoin's not the place either. I mean, I like it for lots of other reasons, but I don't think it's ready to be the safe haven. I've never understood, quite honestly, why the yen was considered safe haven, and the yen seems to strengthen when things start to get ugly. So I am compelled by the fact that if there is some really bad bump in the night, the dollar will strengthen. I don't have any illusions that the dollar is going to keep weakening in that area. Now, If it happens to be, with one caveat, if it happens to be a bump in the night in the Middle East, then I can really get on the other side of, look, if oil prices were to suddenly rise sharply and, you know, we still have a petrodollar system out there, then I'd have to really jump back and say, okay, I can't be short the dollar here. I'll just have to wait for a better entry point. But I can't argue with you that we have a better solution at this point as a safe haven.
So I think a safe haven trade's already on. Like, and it's interesting, right? There was an article in the New York Times. If you remember back this summer, you had, you know, UAE and Saudi get into it and the dollar fell. And you had trouble in Saudi and the dollar fell. And so the New York Times actually ran an article under in the Trump era, dollar no longer safe haven. And it was basically just quoting all these longtime traders, noting that, you know, all this bad economic news, geopolitical, and the dollar kept falling on that. And to me, you know, if we go back to the point of, you know, the chief economist of the IMF saying the U.S. is on the clock, they got to fix this. This was an emerging market problem. They need to take emerging market steps. And if they don't, the next one's going to be worse. Well, if you lay out all these statistics of the United States, if this was any other nation except the United States, what you do is very straightforward. You sell the currency and you put it into dollars. You put it into treasuries. But the problem, to Jeff's point, is the dollar. And everybody knows it's the dollar. They don't know what to do about it. But how do you get out of the dollar? There's nowhere else big enough to go. Well, the one area that's big enough to go that can hedge your currency risk, I think election night 2016 was extraordinarily instructive to a lot of people. Oh my gosh, this was a surprise. The Dow's down 1,000 points for 6 hours. Can you trade that? Most people can't. And so what do you do if the dollar has a problem? I know what I do. If I am running, you know, if I can't trade a 1,000-point move in 6 hours in my sleep, you know what I do? If I'm running a sovereign wealth fund, $400 billion, I go from, you know, 65% equities, 35% bonds, I go 70-30 equities to bonds. Because at the end of the day, you look back at all these big currency system transitions, they're extraordinary inflationary to the currency that's losing status, and there's nowhere else to go. Gold's not big enough. And certainly you've seen physical flows move tremendously over the last 5 years, but no one watches physical flows. I think what you're seeing in equity markets and what you're seeing in Bitcoin, and what you're seeing in Da Vinci's and what you're seeing in real estate, is the everything bubble is a completely rational response to the dollar bubble. The response that, yeah, we could have another crisis, sure. And it's probably going to last, you know, if you look at the last 2 years, each crisis has gone from like 2 weeks to 1 week to 2 days to 6 hours. So like, why would I ever sell? The next crisis, we know how it's going to be resolved. Reflexivity. Does anybody think the Fed isn't going to buy everything that's not bolted down?
Yeah.
I think you're seeing the flight to safety, but you're seeing the flight to safety that you're seeing in Venezuela. Where do they go in Venezuela for safety? Go into stocks. Look at the stock market. Where do they go in Argentina? Where do they go in, you know, Weimar Germany? They went to the stock market.
Great point.
You have to. It's the only place you can go that's liquid enough.
Any other reaction from Luke or Jeff to Mark's deck before we move on?
I would just say that there's a lot to be said about, Eric, your point. There's definitely something like institutional inertia where people are either in denial or they just don't think it's a big enough problem, so they talk themselves out of it. And that's one of the reasons why the system has lasted as long as it has, is because it's almost recency bias. To Luke's point about the stock market, I think there's some of that there too as well, that there is a lot of rationalizations about why stocks are the way they are. I'm not sure that anybody has any real idea what that is. It could be that it's investors are trading for massive growth that's going to show up out of nowhere. That's sort of like the dot-com bubble, where the promises of the new economy were supposed to be delivered in the 21st century, and of course never did. And it could be just that people are preparing for something other than the dollar to be the position that it's in. But whatever the case is, I think there's a whole lot of mistaken expectations about where we are right now. I think that's exactly what our discussion has been here, is trying to figure out what that might be. I think the four of us are relatively smart individuals who are pretty well plugged into these markets and these places. Can you imagine what it's like to be a lay person on the street right now? It's a very confusing time. And I think as it's confusing for regular folks, that they're going to make a lot of mistakes in what they do.
And it's fascinating, too, because as incredible as it is to say that you know, the stock market rising is simply a safety bid. If you look at IRS statistics for the United States, if you add net capital gains and IRA distributions, those two line items last year were over 200% of the year-over-year growth in U.S. personal consumption expenditures, or PCE. PCE is 65% of U.S. GDP. And that 200% number does not include stock options, which is included in, or incentive stock, both of which are included in ordinary income. And so the point is that if anything happens to stocks on the downside, the U.S. government's funding problem becomes instant. And I think Mr. Market starts to figure things out, you know, sort of wisdom of crowds before. Like, I think there is also starting to be the understanding of this reflexivity that the stock market has become the most important fundamental to U.S. consumption, which is the most important fundamental to the U.S. economy. And so you get into this chicken and egg problem. But at the very least, if I'm the U.S. government, I don't feel bad about a bubble. I hope the thing goes to $100,000 or goes to 100,000 on the Dow, like Warren Buffett said, like 2 years from now, because that's the only way the U.S. government can generate enough receipts to pay these entitlements.
Yeah. And what's the flip side of all that? You know, who else is buying stocks but the companies themselves? And that's certainly a liquidity move. That's definitely a liquidity preference, because if you're a company and you have internal cash flow, which hasn't been great, by the way, you know, earnings aren't really rising. Cash flow is not really rising. It's less risky to buy back your own shares than it is to invest in new facilities.
Absolutely.
You know, CapEx and things like that. So, I mean, that's the inverted nature of this kind of a position that we're in, where we stand here and you think, well, buying stocks at this level is the most risky thing you can do. But from inside the boardroom, it looks the opposite way.
Absolutely. And it looks that way from the central banks, too. I mean, you got the Swiss National Bank printing money and buying U.S. stocks.
Exactly right.
At the same time that,
you know, largest holders.
Oh, yeah. Look who the biggest buyer of treasuries have been since 2008, right? The biggest marginal buyers have been, number one, U.S. retail investors. Number two, U.S. commercial banks, essentially forced by the U.S. banking or by the U.S. government to buy. And then U.S. pensions. And you go, when was the last time those three guys were on the right side of a big macro trade together ahead of time? You know, I've been in this business almost 25 years. I struggle to recall a time when they were. And, you know, that's harsh to say, but unfortunately, it's just sort of the nature of the beast. And you go, okay, so the Swiss National Bank's buying stocks and the contraindicators are buying U.S. treasuries. How do I think this movie's going to end?
The only one I'll poke you a little on, I don't, not poke you, so it's the wrong way, Luke, is the banks buying treasuries, totally logical, right? If I could borrow at 25 basis points or 50 basis points and buy treasuries risk-free, I'd lever the hell out of that and I'd make a lot of money, which is what the banks are doing. So I would take the banks out of there as a counter indicator, but you're right, the pension funds, you know, this big announcement recently that CalPERS was going to sell all their stocks and buy treasuries has to be the biggest counter indicator I've ever seen. I mean, crazy.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Luke Grohman, let's move on to the forest for the trees slide deck next. Why don't you take it away from here and tell us your perspective on this?
Yeah, thanks, Eric. I think the overriding theme that we're going to talk about in this is, you know, and we sort of have touched on it in a couple parts of the discussion thus far, is there's a geopolitical and sort of historical angle that generally speaking, most market participants don't pay much or any attention to. And so we're going to highlight some of those and start tying some of that back into sort of the, you know, our lens of what we think it drove and what it implies going forward. So if you go to slide two, to me, the quote here that's in the title and it's included in the body as well, with this concentration of financial and commercial power comes the ability to wield American dollars as weapons. And as an American citizen, I'm scratching my head a little bit about just the epic hubris of such a statement. This was from a book called Treasury's War by Juan Zarate, who was a former U.S. Treasury official. But to basically say we're going to use the dollar to beat you over the head anytime you do something you don't like and not expect rivals or enemies of the United States to react, to me seems misguided, to be kind. And so, of course, as you go to slide three, guess what happens? You know, Chinese general contain the United States by attacking its finances. You know, to effectively contain the United States, other countries shall think more about how to cut off the capital flow to the U.S. Importantly, this general in the Chinese PLA, People's Liberation Army, he wrote a book called Unrestricted Warfare in 1999, talking about these strategies. So it's often thought that China only plays defense. But if you sort of broaden out the reading list a bit, you start to see real evidence that they're not just playing defense over the last couple of years. This same general gave a speech 2 years ago. What's fascinating is the second paragraph on slide four, noting that
the most important incident in the eyes of this PLA general, most important incidents in the 20th century, was not World War I, World War II, not the collapse of the Soviet Union. The most important event of the 20th century was the decoupling of the dollar from gold on August 15th, 1971. And at the bottom, he says exactly what the implications are. To put it simply, Americans can get physical wealth from all over the world by printing a piece of green paper. There's never been such a thing in human history. And so you can start to infer how China actually feels about this. We go to slide 5. They refer to the United States as colonizing the world through the dollar. And then on slide 6, he goes on and talks about that the United States needs, you know, they basically outsource so much of their real economy that it's a hollow economy. So financialized, it requires the United States to make sure capital moves into the United States at the right times. And in the speech, he goes on to talk about how they have incited and or used a variety of different geopolitical moves, including the U.S. military, to make sure that money is moved to the safe haven dollar. And so when you look at it that way, this sort of what's happening in North Korea starts to look very auspicious. That takes us to slide 7. Back in 1999, a gentleman named Sergei Glazyev, who is now a senior economic advisor to Putin, wrote a book. In it, he said that the U.S. led IMF shock therapy policies in Russia in the 1990s had approximately similar results in terms of losses of national wealth and losses of Russian population as the biggest tragedies in Russian history, which were, to his words, Napoleon's invasion, the fascist aggression of the Hitlerites, and the fratricidal civil war, which was, you know, the Russian Revolution. And so he goes on to say this was coordinated by Treasury Secretary Larry Summers and IMF Deputy Director Stan Fisher, who just resigned as Vice Chairman of the Fed. Whether you agree with his assessment or the Chinese general's assessment or not, you understand where their red line is by reading this. You understand that they are willing to go to the mattresses on the dollar and that what they are doing is not just some random activity, that they're playing strict defense. There is definitely what is tantamount to currency war. If you go to slide 8, you can start to see some of the tactical steps. This was a headline from Reuters, August of 2014. Putin's going to start selling oil and gas in rubles globally. The dollar monopoly in energy trade is damaging the economy. And as we kind of noted, I think during Jeff's talk, oil was still about $100 a barrel at this point.
Let me stop you there and just ask a couple of questions. I've followed Sergei Glazyev for a long time. And, you know, he's been talking about this de-dollarization thing for a long time. And until very recently, he was pretty much ignored by everybody outside of Russia. And so is it your contention that his desires are finally catching on? And certainly with what we're seeing with this yuan-denominated contract, it seems like maybe even Glazyev is starting to lean towards, okay, the ruble is not going to make it. We can't try to assert ruble-denominated oil across the world. Maybe the yuan is a better place to start. Do you think that that's what's going on?
You know, it's interesting. When you want to understand if the United States thinks somebody is serious, see how we treat them. In the rash of sanctions of individuals in early 2014, if you recall that, we generally were sanctioning wealthy men in Russia and their bank accounts in response to the Ukraine. We sanctioned one economist, the only economist I've ever seen sanctioned by the United States. Guess who it was? Sergei Glazyev. Why would the United States government sanction Sergei Glazyev unless they thought he was a serious person making real tracks? And to me, that is a huge clue that he was absolutely making headway with that view. As far as the rubles, yeah, I don't disagree. Ultimately, I think if you see what Russia has been doing with gold that whole time, I think Russia is able to accomplish the same thing by doing what they're doing, which is redenominate their FX reserves, control of their FX reserves with their biggest economic output. The more gold they have, the more economic independence and freedom and monetary independence they have from the dollar. So I think it's a move in the same direction on a slightly different path.
Well, Luke, here's a question for you. I mean, if this statement from Putin was from 2014, again, I come back to what are they waiting for? Because between the time he said that statement and now, the Russian economy has been decimated again by another ruble crisis. If there was an alternative to do this, if they had the opportunity to do this, to replace the dollar in any significant way, what are they waiting for?
I think some of it is diplomatic / geopolitical. But I think if you start pricing oil in non-dollars, that makes perfect sense. The dollar should skyrocket, right? Because you're talking about against a very large installed base of dollar demand from the outstanding offshore debt and the euro dollar system itself. If you start choking off at that point at $100 a barrel, shoot, you're probably talking almost $3 trillion a year in oil flows alone, let alone natural gas, right? So if you just start whittling that down just a bit, you would think that at the announcement that, hey, we're dumping the dollar in oil trade would be really bad for the dollar. It's not. It's really good for the dollar in the short run.
Yeah, but they haven't made any progress in actually denominating oil in rubles. In other words, they say that this is bad. It's hurting us. We intend to do something. And then nothing.
Yeah, I think that they are, to Mark's point, I think they're playing more of a long game, right? So if it's just Russia, as big as they are in oil, they need their friends coming along. Iran was on board right away. Of course, Iran was sanctioned. Again, if this wasn't a threat, why would the U.S. sanction Iran? Why would the U.S. sanction Russia? Why are we sanctioning Venezuela's oil industry as people are starving to death? It doesn't make sense unless it was a threat.
Sorry to interrupt, but I guess my point is, let's say they are, let's just for the sake of argument, agree that they're playing the long game here.
Yep.
But in the short term, they're getting killed. Can they afford to play a long game? I guess that's what I'm saying is, can they afford to play a long game when their economies are taking massive damage because of what's actually happening today? Can you afford to be that patient? And why wouldn't they be, I guess, more impatient is where I'm trying to get at.
I think the reason they're being more impatient is they're Easterners, right? At the end of the day, they can't afford to stay on the dollar. If they stay on the dollar, then by 2030, when we print a big chunk of this $100 trillion of entitlements, they will have a pile of 0% yielding paper and all their oil will be pumped out and they'll be done. It's over. They have to take the pain now, because as much pain as it is, and it is pain, there's no question, it's less than the pain of, hey, ship all your oil to the Americans or ship all your oils out for dollars, and those dollars are made worthless in real terms. Then all of a sudden, you have to be importing oil back in at $1,000 a barrel that you were selling at 50 15 years ago.
Yeah, and I think the other piece of it is this statement was made in advance of the Saudi-Turkey announcement, a few months later, where basically single-handedly collapsed the oil market by cutting production. So you can argue and debate why they did that. Were they going after U.S. shale? I have always believed that they were going after Russia. It was no surprise to me that the president of the United States was meeting with the Saudis the week before the big announcement, or big non-announcement. And I think that it's all gamesmanship. And I don't remember who said it, but if the difference, maybe it was Luke that said, the difference between whether you get attacked and whether you get sanctioned is whether you have nuclear weapons or not. So the reality is Russia really wanted to move in this direction, and were trying in lots of different ways, but they got their legs cut off literally and figuratively by the Saudis pushing prices down. And then everybody lost control, right? When oil hit 26 bucks, they clearly had lost control. And that's when they had to take the desperate measures in China and pump the $1 trillion of stimulus in and literally buy up the futures market activity in commodity futures, oil futures in particular, in the third week of February of 2016 was 10 times the normal volume. They clearly were saving the oil price.
Well, if you look at it too.
Well, Mark, I guess, go ahead, Luke.
I was just going to say, I think Russia was dictating terms the whole time. I think Saudi was reacting. Or if you go into that Turkey meeting, that non-decision, everyone on Wall Street, except for us, was saying OPEC was going to cut production. And what we were saying was, why would they? Because ultimately, Russia was going to win share in China. There's the only market that's going to grow for oil in any real way over the next 25 years is China and Asia. And so it really came down to, China, and really China's driving this with Russia. Price in oil will give you market share. And interestingly, the Saudis said, all right, well, even if we cut, all we're going to do is cede share to shale. So we're not going to do that. We're just going to run full out. And so it's interesting, about 8 months later, when Kazakhstan devalued their currency, and they flat out said, Russia selling in yuan is forcing us to do this, the prime minister of Kazakhstan said, the Russians are on the free oil system, the free currency oil system, right? Basically, it became less about, supply and demand of oil and, what is the Fed doing? And it became supply, demand of oil and what's your currency doing? Because the ruble collapsed, and all of a sudden, with the yuan down versus the dollar, ruble down versus the dollar, Russia's the cheapest guy in the world, and they're doing all the deals, or they're doing deals in yuan to China, they're gaining a lot of share. And how did China benefit from this? You know, to your point, Jeff, this bought them time. The price of oil collapsed. Their current account surplus blew out. The pressure that they were feeling on the dollar shortage eased markedly in 2014. It bought them time. And so I think this is China and Russia mutually looking at this. And importantly, it shifts the reference point of oil from the dollar to gold. Did Russia Russia bought gold this whole time, unlike 98, unlike 08. And the price of gold priced in oil from fall of 14 doubled. It went from 13 barrels of an oil per ounce to 30 barrels of an oil per ounce. So if Russia's got, you know, 1,000 tons, guess what happened to the value of their FX reserves of gold in terms of their biggest economic output oil? They're richer. Their reserves rose. So you see it. What they're doing is it makes their economy unsinkable and away from the dollar in the long run. And I think that's, they're playing the long game. They know that all they got to do is just keep doing this and the dollar will collapse under its own weight. They don't need to be aggressive.
Well, I guess that's my point. If they're playing the long game, what that says to me is that there is no viable alternative on the horizon. Because if you're stuck facing all of those kinds of factors, and they're all negative, and I get what you're saying, Luke, about gold and oil and valuing their reserves, but the reality of the situation is you do need dollars. That's just the way it is. The way the world works today is you have to have dollars. And I have to believe that if there was a viable alternative to that system, it would be up and running. 2015 was the perfect time to do it before the damage hit, late 2014, before everything started to really go bad for everybody. If there was an opportunity to do it, I think they would have. I mean, that's what we've been talking about the last few days, is they've had every incentive to do that because the system doesn't work. It doesn't work for even us, let alone China or Russia. And if you're going to take in a massive economic damage, I mean, if you're stuck playing the long game with that, then that just means you have no short game.
I think the alternative's ready to go at a moment's notice. I just think, to your point, I don't know why they haven't. If China and Russia agree that the value of the gold sitting on all their books is 1,000 barrels per ounce, not 25 barrels per ounce, I assure you there's plenty of dollars out there. Supply of dollars is simply a function of the gold price if you look at where the gold's now sitting. And at why they haven't done that yet? I don't know. It could be any given Sunday. Maybe they're just, again, in terms of the non-confrontational style of China, as opposed to Russia, who tends to be more confrontational, it gives you a sense of maybe who's driving the boat. Why be the bad guy when you can do the math on the U.S. entitlement picture and what'll happen to tax receipts, and you'll know that the Fed's going to have to cry uncle first. It's a mathematical certainty. There's really no mystery to it. You can do the math because unless 75 million baby boomers disappear in the next 6 months, the math is very, very clear.
Hang on a second, Luke, because when you say that there are alternatives, they're ready at a minute's notice. I don't understand what you mean, because it seems to me that the U.S. dollar stays the world's reserve currency and at the center of the financial system for as long as the favored central bank reserve asset around the world is U.S. Treasuries. Now, there's no other bond market around the world that's deep and liquid enough to absorb that amount of capital. So how can you say that there's ready alternatives?
It's not just that. To add to that, there's infrastructure that needs to be done. There needs to be markets. There needs to be protocols of how banks translate trades into each other's systems. I mean, it's not like you can just say tomorrow, we're going to stop using the dollar and start using something else. That's not how banking works.
Oh, no, you're not going to stop. You'll never stop using the dollar. What you're talking about is if you want to settle your deficits in your own sovereign debt, if you want to be the dollar, the price is very steep. It's a very simple, straightforward thing. You get in the short and medium term, you get a debt-fueled government and consumer spending party. And in the long run, you get the bankruptcy of your country. That's Triffin's dilemma. He laid it out very clearly. If you look at how both China and how Europe have structured their currencies, that is not politically acceptable to either of these nations. They are not going to settle deficits in sovereign debt, which are claims on your nation. You're bankrupting your nation in the long run. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to outsource production of Mercedes and BMWs to China or to Africa. They want to keep them there. And you can see that with how the Europeans structured the euro, right? So when back in 99, when the euro was launched, right at the last second, they announced, hey, we're putting 15% of Eurozone reserves into physical gold and we're marking the market quarterly. And it was shocking to people. What are they doing? The Europeans were so star-spangled happy with the dollar, they never would have put 15% of their reserves into the anti-dollar mark-to-market quarterly. It would have just put them in treasuries, and they would have tied their fortunes to the U.S. That was a direct nod to, we are a net oil importer and a net exporter of goods. And so we want to start creating a currency that gives comfort to the Arabs that will hold its purchasing power through the marking to market of the gold quarterly. And right away, Saddam moved over to euros, and the rest is history. China is setting up the same system to do that. And so...
But it didn't work in Europe, though. I mean, the euro, I agree with you. I think that's exactly what the euro was intended to accomplish, but it didn't. The euro never supplanted the dollar.
It didn't accomplish it because they were shocked. We went to war. Remember, were Germany and France in favor of the second Iraq war? They voted against it, remember?
Oh, they were vehemently against it.
Vehemently against it. Why? Because they knew what that war was about. It was about the denomination of euro, oil war. That's what that was. And so why did it not matter then? Well, it didn't matter then because we went to war to defend it. Now, at the time, again, from that point, we had no deficits. We were running a surplus. Our debt was much lower. We were a younger country. And if you look at what happened to the United States funding, the Europeans stopped funding the U.S. basically at that point, in terms of meaningfully increasing their deficits, their FX reserves to fund our deficits. They really kind of walked away from that. And, you know, my pet theory is that that is why Larry Summers said to Brooksley Bjorn, we need to not regulate the interest rate derivatives market. Because in theory, that should have driven rates up then. But how did we deal with that? We allowed interest rate derivatives to expand from $50 trillion to $800 trillion. And that kept interest rates down.
Yeah, but that was European banks. I mean, most of this Eurodollar supply in the middle 2000s came from Europe. So even if the European government wasn't willing to trade in dollars, European banks were more than happy to do so. In fact, that's how they expanded. All of the European banks got massive on dollar businesses.
Right.
And that's why you had nationalizations in 2008, 2009. Over a U.S. housing bubble.
Right. No, and to get back to the original question of where can they create the market, you can create the market through if you make either gold or SDRs big enough. Like, that's the end game to the whole thing. You know, my point is the Europeans and the Chinese have been creating a neutral settlement asset for starting 18 years ago with the launch of the euro. If you make gold big enough, if you make the SDR big enough, then that is the way you transition away from the dollar, where you start selling oil. It's not so much that the dollar loses share, it's that the treasury loses share. The U.S. treasury bond stops settling trade, and it starts being settled in either gold or in SDRs or something of that nature.
Again, we're getting to the A to B problem. We all of us agree that we want to get to B, but how do we get to B? And I think the problem is that nobody has any idea how big the problem is.
You could get to B overnight.
Not without disruption.
Talk through what happens if Saudi and Russia come out and say, we value gold at 1,000 barrels per ounce. Tomorrow.
Well, but wait a minute. I think that in terms of the global financial system, if you're suggesting that we replace the dollar with gold, it seems to me that there's a very, very clear trend that, you know, gold bugs love that idea, but central bankers like the ability to arbitrarily create fiat currency. So going to either...
No. You won't replace it with gold. No. That's not what we're talking about here. You are talking about a neutral settlement asset.
No, we're talking about a transition to a neutral settlement asset. The transition is not crisis-free.
The transition probably is the crisis.
Because you have to revalue everything else in order to achieve that.
The transition probably is the crisis. I mean, you think about it, 2013 up until about 3 months ago, I haven't checked the date in probably 3 or 4 months, global central banks bought more physical gold than they did U.S. treasuries for 4 years. It's a fact. You can see it. The transition is the crisis, in my opinion. What's the implication if Saudi says, hey, we're pricing oil in yuan and we value gold at 1,000 barrels an ounce? And that's probably too big a number for illustrative purposes. But the point is at its core, the petrodollar is a low gold to oil ratio. This is very important. It's a low gold to oil ratio. Gold is kept low by the big, you know, highly levered paper markets so that it doesn't compete with treasury bonds. Oil is needed to be kept expensive to generate the dollar surpluses to fund the U.S. government deficits. And so when you have cheap gold over expensive oil, you get a low gold to oil ratio. What you would do by doing this, if you had Russia and Saudi come out and say, hey, 1,000 barrels an ounce is the new number, not 25 barrels an ounce, the United States has been able to have their cake and eat it too, right? You've got cheap gold and expensive oil. Now the United States will have a choice. You can have expensive gold and expensive oil, or you can have cheap gold and no domestic oil in it. You'll be importing all your oil because, you know, again, 1,000 barrels an ounce. If you say gold is $1,200, great. Oil's $1.20. Shales bye-bye, and that's great. You basically have created what that situation will have done. It sounds crazy. It's exactly what the World Bank president called for. You know, Robert Zoellick, who left the World Bank and went to Goldman, called for in 2010 in the Financial Times. We need all five currencies, and we need, you know, we should consider using gold as a reference point. Gold's a reference point in that case. It is not backed by gold. That's not a gold-backed dollar. It's not a gold-backed euro. That is a gold reference point. 2011, you had DSK, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the IMF. They wrote a white paper. We should consider pricing oil and gold in SDRs. Again, it's a roundabout way of doing the same thing, but you could revalue what's the price of oil and what's the price of gold and what's the relationship between the two through the SDR. And then all five currencies in the SDR, you can infer, okay, that's what that implies for the price of gold and the price of oil in dollars and in euros and in yuan and in yen and in pounds. And of course, you know, 3 months after he did that, he just happened to get, as I put before, unceremoniously deposed. So like, what I'm talking about sounds incredible, but the people that matter have been talking about it for over half a decade.
But it's not incredible at all. In fact, it's entirely logical, and it proceeds from the sequence of events.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, going off the gold standard in 71 and closing the gold window and cutting a deal with the Saudis to basically exchange protection for pricing the new reference commodity in dollars. So anybody who threatens that by either elevating gold or elevating another currency like the euro or elevating now the renminbi or tomorrow Bitcoin, anyone who talks about these things is going to be unceremoniously deposed. And it's not a pretty thing. And the question is, has the power shifted enough such that we, the U.S., can't control the final decision? And it appears.
And that may be the answer to Jeff's question is why, what are they waiting for? Every day that passes makes the U.S. weaker.
You know, and I think that's it exactly. If the balance of power hasn't gone far enough. And I think the reason for it is that there are logistical and infrastructure issues that have not even been close to addressed.
I think it's less that, and I think it's more the military side.
Because no matter how you revalue anything, you shift from one reserve currency to another, that creates winners and losers. And you don't know how much the losers are going to lose and what that could possibly do. Especially in a system like the euro dollar, we have no idea how many euro dollars there are. And the BIS just last month or 2 months ago, looking in the footnotes of bank balance sheets and found $12 to $14 trillion in dollar denominated offshore FX that was every bit as useful and as used as the cash market. And so that's my A to B scenario is how do you get from a place where you have no idea how the system really works to a system that you hope you know how it works.
Isn't that just Putin's retirement fund?
Well, if you were moving in that direction, you'd expect to see things like you would need the new reserve asset. You would need that to move to the right people, right? A big problem a lot of gold investors make, gold bugs, however you want to call it, is everyone wants to think of gold as actually like a market asset. It is not. It is a political asset.
And it's concentrated in very few hands. It's not distributed widely.
Exactly right. So if you are going to resolve this issue the way I described, the way the World Bank hinted at, the way the IMF talked about, you would expect to start to see things like gold flowing to those nations. If that's going to be a new reserve asset, then, you know, okay, the United States needs to have a lot. The Europeans need to have a lot. And when I say the Europeans, the Germans need to have a lot. And what have the Germans been doing? They've been asking for their gold back, haven't they? You would need the Chinese to have a whole lot. And how do you do that? One way to do it is you make sure the price of gold doesn't move in dollars because Americans don't buy something that's not rising. It's cultural. Chinese buy more. Indians buy more when it falls. Americans, they won't buy something that's not moving in price. In addition to these very powerful institutions, Western institutions advocating for these things, you're seeing actual movement since they advocated for them of things that would support that. Now, again, is gold it, or is it gold going into the SDR? Is it SDRs getting revalued much higher and that filters through to gold? I don't know, but it has to be a neutral settlement asset to fix the system. And to your point, Jeff, of we don't know how big it is, that just tells you how big it's eventually got to be. Like, you know, what we've been saying is like gold is the credit default trade of this cycle. Like it's going to be 1,000, 1,200,000 people playing with the paper back and forth. And then you're going to wake up one day and it's going to be like 13,000. Have a good day. And you're either, and physical only, by the way, because if you look at, you know, the GLD, there's all this language. Hey, sorry, we can cash settle you. We'll cash settle you. It'll be like CDS, right? If Goldman's long paper gold, when it happens, everyone long paper gold is going to get paid. If Goldman and the systemically important banks are short gold, when it happens, anyone who owns paper gold ain't going to get paid.
Well, that's a problem for JP Morgan, isn't it? Since they're short, theoretically, two times the world's gold production.
Theoretically, yeah. The way I think it'll really work is if something like this happens, we'll wake up and then JP Morgan and Goldman be like, hey, so in this room, we have all this physical gold over here. We never knew we had it.
Let me throw an example, which I think is kind of similar, but not quite.
This was such a great conversation that it was hard again to choose a point to cut things off for this episode, but we had to leave it there. Don't worry, we'll pick it up right where we left off in part 4, which airs this coming Saturday, December 30th. Please tune back in then when we'll finish Luke Groman's slide deck and then dive into our conclusions and predictions about how the dollar endgame will play out, how long it will take, and what the landscape will look like after the dust settles. All of that is coming up in Macro Voices episode 98, which airs on December 30th, 2017. This special series was originally conceived as only 2 parts and was enabled directly by generous donations from our listeners. When we discovered that doing justice to the material would require 5 full hours of content, needless to say, we overspent our production budget considerably. So if you're able to make a donation to help us defray our production expenses this holiday season, it will be greatly appreciated, and it will make possible for us to bring you even more special content in the coming year. We also urgently need your help rating and reviewing Macro Voices on iTunes, because these ratings control our ranking in the business podcast directory, which is very important for growing the show, which helps us get better and better feature interview guests for your listening pleasure. To rate and review Macro Voices, simply open the iTunes application on your computer and click on the search box at the top right. Choose Store, and then type Macro Voices into the search box. Then right-click the large Macro Voices logo. You may have to scroll down to find the podcasts heading as opposed to the episodes heading. But under podcasts, click on the Macro Voices logo. And then to the right of our logo on the next page, click ratings and reviews. If you've enjoyed Macro Voices, please choose 5 stars just to the right of the words click to rate, and then click the write a review button just below and type in your comments. We really appreciate your donations and your ratings and reviews, and all of us at Macro Voices wish you and yours a safe and happy 2017 holiday season.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.